Alright, it's morphin' time! Dragon Sword!
This is Jason David Frank, and you are listening to This Week in Geek, and it's morphin' time.
Did you grow up with the NES, PlayStation, Star Wars, cartoons, and 80s TV? Do you like to think who would win in a fight between Batman and the Master Chief? Comics, games, movies, music, and TV, they're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back, they're gonna save the world of geeks. Movies, music, and TV, they're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back, they're gonna save the world of This Week in Geek. This Week in Geek.
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to This Week in Geek, and I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dodd. And well, guys, as you guys know from watching my Twitter, at Birdman Dodd, by the way, I have a huge interest in science. And last week, I talked with a lot of people from Star Trek, and that got me interested in some of the neat solar things that are happening in our solar system. And one of the things that I like to do is I like to follow interesting people on Twitter. However, this interesting person came to me first. And I'm talking about Tamitha Scove. She is a space physicist. She has a channel on YouTube. She does some work for some government agencies, which I can't name. And she's an all-around pretty smart person and definitely has earned her chops when talking about the solar weather that happens, like I said, in our very own solar system. And not a lot of people really know a lot about it. I had no idea there was actually a space weather forecast, which comes out from certain agencies every day. Tamitha's is on her podcast on her YouTube channel every week. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Tamitha to the show. So it's exciting. I was so happy when you found me on Twitter because I'm like, oh my god, a real scientist followed me.
Well, I'm also a geek too, so you know, there was a natural attraction there.
It's tremendously cool to be able to speak with someone who actually has a huge background in this. So I guess for those of my listeners that aren't familiar with your work, what is the origin story and who are you?
Well, I'm actually someone who started out more as an artist and a very big sci-fi buff. And as a kid, I used to read a lot of science fiction novels. And then somehow along the way, I was turned on to actual science. And I started finding that, believe it or not, the concepts behind a lot of physics principles, and especially space, ended up being more completely whacked out and crazy than the authors that I was reading. So what ended up happening is that I eventually traded in my sci-fi novels and fantasy novels for textbooks and started down the path of physics. And space has always been a big fascination, and especially the sun. So very early on, I gravitated toward that, no pun intended, and started taking a much more close look at what we call solar ejections, coronal mass ejections. These are basically when the sun decides to burp, for lack of a better phrase, and send bits and pieces of itself out hurtling towards Earth. And these things have very beautiful shapes, and if anyone has ever looked at pictures of the sun and seen these big monstrous ejections, and know that they're mesmerizing to look at. But they actually contain a lot of really interesting structure that is governed by magnetic fields. We're talking about the fields that, you know, are the same that as a bar magnet that you put on your fridge. And they interact with the Earth's shield. See, here's the sci-fi part. We actually do have a shield. It's the same magnetic field that you read on a compass, but it actually extends into space. And how these things interact with that shield that protects us became just incredibly fascinating to me. And so it led me down this path of actually doing what we call space physics, It's not astronomy, which most people get very confused about. I don't study distant stars. I don't know much about quasars. I don't know much about pulsars. I study what is in our backyard, basically everything from the sun to the earth and how it affects us, because to me that's far more important, how it affects life and society than studying something that may be very beautiful, but will, you know, we can't touch and feel, and it doesn't really affect us other than pretty pictures. So that's kind of how I came to be who I am. And when I started talking to people, I actually also run a recording studio because I do music as well. And when I started talking a little bit about my space physics and my exploits in that arena to clients at the time, they just became fascinated, and I would just get bombarded by questions. And it made me realize that there are a lot of people out there who are very, very interested in this stuff. So it kind of helped me learn how to talk to people without all the heavy mumbo-jumbo of science jargon, so that people didn't get lost. And so I was able to take them along and have them enjoy the journey along with me.
Now, one of the things that I've been learning over the course of the past year, I've only really taken an interest in this stuff since April. I found another channel on YouTube, which you and I are both subscribed to, called Suspicious Observers. And it's really got me thinking about just how much the sun interacts with our planet. I mean, obviously, the providing light and basically making us alive. Why is it we don't hear a lot about it whenever people talk about space? They talk about always the other planets or basic astronomy stuff, like you mentioned. Like, we always hear about, hey, there's a new supernova going off, or we discovered this, that, and the other thing. Why do we never talk about the sun?
Well, there's a big history in that. Astronomy is a much older field than space weather. And historically, you know, people have been looking at planets and stars from their backyards with telescopes for centuries. And so that field really has developed dramatically, and it's a much more popular field to for no other reason, because a lot of people know about it. And our own solar system, by contrast, has been, it's oftentimes not considered nearly as interesting. Our planets, you know, okay, they have rings. We can look at them, wonderful. You know, it's not, they're not exploding. There's no supernova. There's no incredibly beautiful, you know, horsehead galaxies and things like that and nebula that are really captivating. But our star in and of itself is really not what an astronomer would consider a very interesting star. It's kind of run of the mill. About every one out of every four or five stars is a star like ours, and most likely even larger than our star. So there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to our star from an astronomy point of view. But it's becoming much more interesting within the last 50 years, because we are actually able to send satellites now, not necessarily to the sun, but to other planets, and we're beginning with Solar Probe and Solar Orbiter to try to get satellites to the sun, and we're staring at them more, and we're being able to get what we call in situ data. That means we don't just get pretty pictures looking at them from afar. We actually can put spacecraft in space that can measure quantitatively things that are happening at the location of that spacecraft. And so we're learning a lot more detailed physics. So the field is growing. As a matter of fact, it's growing incredibly rapidly, but it still has a long way to go to catch up to astronomy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, because I understand there's a couple of different satellites which actually observe the sun directly, and we can actually take it. I think there's actually a website for it. Isn't it called, like, helioviewer.com or something like that?
Yes, helioviewer.org, and that does mostly SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is the one that's been launched recently, which is an absolute powerhouse. It also allows you to look at SOHO data. SOHO was the solar monitor prior to SDO. But there have been observations prior to that. We had Solar Maxwell mission. We even had Skylab, for crying out loud. That was actually had a solar telescope that was staring at the sun. And then we've got tons of ground stations. There's Big Bear Observatory, the Wilcox Observatory in Stanford. You know, there's all sorts of other ground-based observatories that stare at the sun to get quantitative estimates of what's going on both on the sun's surface and in its atmosphere, what we call the corona, and also underneath the surface in the interior of the sun.
Now, one of the things that I've heard about, and I'd love to hear you expand upon it just because I want to understand more about it, and as well for my listeners, the sun operates in cycles where there's solar maximums and solar kind of minimums. And I understand right now we're in a solar maximum, which means we should be seeing a lot more solar flares and bigger ones, but we're really not. Can you maybe explain what I'm talking about to my listeners who aren't maybe so scientifically inclined?
Absolutely. The sun actually goes through what we call pseudo-cycles. They're not really perfectly timed. We say that the typical solar cycle lasts about 11 years. But there's actually, on top of that 11-year periodicity, there are multiple cycles. There are other cycles that are actually even longer. And they modulate is the best phrase, but what they do is they add, if for a less scientific term, they add to or subtract from the current cycle. So, for instance, during all of the space age, where we've actually had what we call the space age, from essentially the 1950s on up to the current day, we have been in something we call the grand maximum period. And we actually had, it's when we have our typical 11-year cycle, and on top of that, we're adding something that's around a 50-year cadence, maybe a little bit longer than that. You're adding extra, even more punch to each one of these cycles. Now, as of about 2006, we've been exiting that grand maxima, that extra punch that's been added to the cycles, and now we're entering what's called a grand minimum period. And this may be another 50 years or so of a subtraction off of the major cycle, or off of the typical 11-year cycle. So instead of adding an extra punch, it's actually taking some of that punch away. So it's making the cycles actually weaker than they normally would be. And it's calming the activity down, and it's actually what happens is how it affects the 11-year cycle is that as when you have strong cycles, these cycles actually are shrink down in length. So if you have a really strong cycle, then it may not be 11 years. It may be as short as 9. But if you have a really weak cycle, like we do now, the cycle lengthens. So instead of an 11-year cycle, you might actually have a 14-year cycle. So it's one of these kind of stretchy, springy kind of push-pull types of effects that then kind of modify how the cycles end up, actually turning out to be. And scientists, we have yet to understand exactly why. As a matter of fact, there's some really hot debate right now in terms of the internal, there's my dog, in terms of some internal mixing of the sun's interior. We've just recently, because of the Solar Dynamics Observatory, we've recently been able to get better measurements on the interior of the sun, and we're seeing some of our theories being upended because we may have a much more complicated condition inside the sun that then generates the activity cycle than what we previously assumed. So what's happening now is that our cycle is slowing down, and how that affects the activity is not only does it diminish it altogether, but when you get the solar maximum, it's slowing down how the magnetic poles are flipping. It's really all run by magnetic fields. So you're taking a bar magnet and essentially flipping it over. So the north pole becomes a south pole and the south pole becomes a north pole. But when you slow things down in slow motion with the sun, what happens is that one pole flips faster than the other. And right now, the North Pole has flipped over, and the South Pole has yet to flip. So what ends up happening is that it makes the field very, very, very weak. And it makes the field very weak. And so it changes. I don't want to go into super detail, but it ends up making the field so weak that it can't really create sunspots right now. But once the south pole finally flips, the dominant term, what we call the dipole term of the field, will come back and you'll start seeing sunspots again, you'll start seeing flares again, and what we call a double peak in the maximum. And that's what's being expected right now.
Now, one of the things that I've heard, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, how do solar flares, what do they mean to Earth? I mean, do we need them, so to speak? I mean, are they essential to basically Earth as a whole because they interact with our magnetic shield?
That's an interesting question. I've not really heard anyone say whether or not we actually need solar flares. We definitely need the sun's light and the sun's heat. Solar flares add an extra, maybe an extra input to that, but I don't necessarily think the Earth needs them to survive. They're not, they're such transient, short-lived events that I don't think they make that much of a difference. What they make a difference to are the things that we have, our technologies that we have up in space right now.
Now, there was something that I read on Wikipedia. Yes, I know, the most reliable source ever. Back in the 1800s, there was this huge solar flare, and it caused something called the Carrington event. And this is something I'm tremendously interested in. And maybe you could tell my listeners, because it kind of ties into what you just said, how solar flares are a threat to our technology in space and on Earth.
Yes, but there's two things to understand about solar flares and basically about sun solar events. You have something called a solar flare, which is a huge, very rapid release of energy. And it can send what we call radio bursts towards Earth, and it can send particles that are moving at almost the speed of light. Very energetic, and these particles can cause a lot of problems for satellites, not just communicating to the ground, but also it can help charge them up, and it can cause radiation doses, like getting chest X-rays, things like that, that can really make it very, very difficult for the satellites to function. But those are short-lived, and what I mean by short-lived, it's typically an hour or more for let's say the radio bursts, which can disrupt communication, can disrupt your GPS signals, can disrupt ham radio operators, can disrupt airline flights, communications and stuff like that. Particle storms, those can last even longer, and those can cause issues, bigger issues for spacecraft. And of course, anyone who's flying in a plane, if they're flying a transcontinental or an intercontinental flight, they oftentimes go up over the poles in very high altitudes, and it actually will get a radiation dose because of that. And that's why a lot of times you'll hear me say, if we're in the middle of a radiation storm, I say, pregnant women, please be advised, you might not want to fly right now because of that. And air crews actually have to monitor that kind of thing, because they're actually considered radiation workers because they do fly when there are radiation storms from space weather. But then the sun also sends out a much more slow ejection. And this is the things that I studied as a grad student. These are coronal mass ejections, and they are much more massive, and they take a longer time to reach Earth. They drive shock waves ahead of them, and when they hit the Earth's shield, depending upon how they're configured, again, it's all run by magnetic fields. So it's like taking two bar magnets. And if you put two of them together and they're upside down from each other, they repel, they push each other away. But then if you flip one over, it goes click, right? You can click them together, and then it's the same kind of thing with the Earth's shield. If the magnetic field of the solar storm is the right configuration, it will click together with the Earth's shield and pump all of its energy inside the Earth's shield into the near-Earth space. And that's what really caused all the damage during the Carrington event. It wasn't the flare. It was the coronal mass ejection that was launched, this big solar storm that was launched at the Earth that arrived a few days after the flare.
Huh. Well, now I know. Just mind blown right there. Now, One of the things that I remember from a couple of years ago, there was a movie that you probably know where I'm going with this one, that actually talked about coronal mass ejections and how it's this huge death sentence for Earth. This was the Nicolas Cage movie called Knowing. And it's a movie that's often cited for its horribly bad depiction of CMEs. I guess my question is, if people wanted to become more educated about this stuff, to have it, I'm not going to say dumbed down, but in terms that they can understand, where would they go to find out more information, to get them more interested in stuff like this?
You know, I've had people ask me that before. They keep asking me, are there introductory texts for laymen about space weather? And you know what? The field is so new that there really aren't many, if any at all, that have been written by credible scientists. There have been a few that I've seen that in blogs and things like that, but there's usually misinformation in those. So I have not yet seen anything written that I feel comfortable recommending as a source. You know, there's a lot of information out there, but a lot of it is still littered with scientific jargon that may be more or less easy to understand. I've actually been asked by quite a few people to write something, and I'm actually thinking about doing that for exactly that reason. And again, part of it is to do with trying to dispel the myth about the Carrington event and the myth about the flare kill shot. You know, those events do exist, and will we see one in our lifetimes? There's a chance, yeah. There's actually a decent chance, especially as we come out of the Dalton minimum, maybe within the next 50 years or so. But
I'm just go ahead. No, I was about to say, you said the word kill shot there. That kind of got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
That's a term that's been floating around forever. Well, it's like the Carrington event.
Okay.
The idea of a flare kill shot, it's really, again, it's a misnomer because it's not a flare that's going to take us out, so to speak. It's the CME. It's the solar storm that arrives a few days later. And that solar storm, not only does it drive beautiful things like the aurora, but it drives current systems in our magnetic shield, and those current systems can get transferred to the ground. And although we're talking about currents that are not very strong, people have a tendency to misunderstand. They think, oh my goodness, everything, you know, my pacemaker is going to short out. No, these are very, very weak currents. If you can think of the Earth's shield as being about as strong as a fridge magnet, it's really not much stronger than that. But what it has that people don't understand is that it can act over a very, very large region. So what you look at when you're inducing currents into wires and things is that the wires have to be extremely long. They have to run hundreds of miles unimpeded. And the only things that do that really are things like oil pipelines and electricity grids. So our electric grids, if you've heard a lot of concern about whether or not our electric grids could handle an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, due to a solar storm, for example. Because we've had problems like that in the past. Back in 1989, half of Canada, not half of Canada, but a good portion of Canada went down with a Hydro-Quebec grid. Maine also had issues and lost power. We do have to worry about reinforcing our electric grids, but it's not going to be anything like the Carrington event, because back in the 1850s, when this happened, the transmission lines that they had then, this was telegraph wires, they ran completely unimpeded for literally north, south, east, west, hundreds of miles with no concern whatsoever of space weather. And so big currents were able to run down these lines, and they actually, what happened is that they'd actually come through the wall, through the telegraph machines, and set the paper on fire because they were sparking and arcing. They set the paper on fire. Telegraph operators actually got burned. People would unplug these telegraph machines from the wall and they'd still function because they were just getting lots of current. But we don't have nearly that kind of setup anymore with our electric grids. There are a lot of them are segmented. They've got transformers along the way. You can shut them down piecewise. So Could we have failures? Yes. But would they set buildings on fire like I've seen? You know who I'm talking about if you've seen his video about that. No, they're not going to set buildings on fire. It's not going to be anything catastrophic like that. Could we lose power? Sure. For days? Possibly.
So but, it's not going to be a catastrophic thing we can't... We're not going back to the Dark Ages, basically.
It will be... Well, we could with the satellites in space, you could say goodbye to your social media. You can say bye to your cell phones. And that may take longer to fix because those satellites up there may be dead. So all your conveniences go away. But is there going to be fire and brimstone? No. You know, could you look at it as a natural disaster? Yeah, you could. And you probably should. But it's the cataclysmic concept is a bit more fear-monger than truthful. And see, that's the thing with me, is that I'm more interested in how space weather affects you every day. I mean, you live it every day, whether you realize it or not. For example, if I had to ask you, could you go one day without you? Which would you rather go one day without? Your car or your cell phone? Which would you choose?
I'd choose my car because I don't leave the house anyway.
Right.
But if I didn't have my cell phone, I'm cut off.
Exactly. Now, that seems like an easy choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to ask you, which could you go without for one day, your car or your satellite? You'd probably say, well, I don't care about satellites. What big deal is that? But what if I tell you that by going without your cell phone, going without satellites is like going without your cell phone? Then you have to say, okay, that means my satellites are more important to me than my car. And as we go further and further into a more technologically advanced society with more social media, with more smartphones, with more apps, and everything that we do online, our satellites are becoming indispensable. And we have to pay attention to space weather. For example, even right now, there's nothing going on in the sun. It's very quiet. And yet people have been telling me that they're having horrible time with their cell phones and their internet. And the reason for that is because we are having all the satellites in what we call the geosynchronous orbit. That's the orbit that circles around the Earth and stays in the same place overhead all the time. So it rotates at the same speed that the Earth does. Those satellites are what we call, they're in what we call the eclipse season right now. That means they can't get, during part of their orbit, they're shadowed. They don't, the Earth is coming between them and the sun. And those satellites depend upon the sun to discharge them because the space environment is so, there's so much radiation and so much electricity up in space that it's like rubbing a balloon on your head all the time. And the sun helps discharge that. Because they're in shadow, they're not getting discharged. So what's happening is that the satellites are shorting out a lot right now. And it's actually affecting people. It's affecting cell phones. It's affecting internet. People are having trouble with that. And the more technologically advanced we get, and the more people rely on these social media and rely on our internet connections and broadband for everything, the more this is going to become a major inconvenience. And that's the kind of space weather I'm interested in. I'm not worried about the flare kill shot that happens once every 100 years. I'm talking about how space weather affects you every single day.
Wow, I've never even thought of it like that. That's a very sobering thought, just to think of how we are so dependent upon them and that, you know, we depend upon satellites for, well, a lot of things now. Wow, thank you for that, actually. Well, Tamitha, I want to thank you for spending a lot of time with us today to basically get my listeners up to speed on what's going on in our planetary backyard, so to speak. So if people wanted to find your stuff online, where would they have to go?
They could go to YouTube and look for Tamitha Scove. I have a channel right there listed as Tamitha Scove. You can also go to, and I can send you links to these later. They go to SCIEANDE.com. That's SCIEANDE. It stands for Science Education and Engagement. And then there's a link to my essentially my homepage on that website. So you can just go, it'll say Tamitha, and you guys, you can get my my bio and my resume or CV if you're that inclined, and read all the heavy science jargon stuff. And it's a new site, so I'm beginning to put more stuff up so people can get a better idea of who I am, because I've not been doing this for very long, but I'm finding that it's becoming very important, especially as GPS becomes plugged into everything. And now we have the FAA, they just recently passed a law saying that drones can share our airspace. And so these will be GPS-enabled drones. And just like I said before, GPS is a signal that is affected by space weather. And so if we're not careful during inclement space weather, we're going to have drones crashing into each other and falling out of the sky and hitting us. And nobody seems to be aware or concerned about it. And like I said, it's something that space weather is going to start becoming more part of our everyday vernacular. It's going to be just an extension of the terrestrial weather we already pay attention to.
Once again, Tamitha, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Well, guys, that was my interview with Tamitha Skov. I really hope you guys check this stuff out. Check out her channel on YouTube. She does a weekly update on what is going on. Follow her on Twitter. There will be a link below. And just, you know what, guys? Take an interest in science. I mean, let's stop focusing on TMZ and let's look up a little in the sky and just kind of be aware of what's kind of going on. This stuff does affect you every day. Let's just say science is a little bit more interesting than gossip. Well, guys, there's going to be a lot of cool content coming out on the site this week, so be sure to be checking that out. And this month's topic show, we're going to be taking a look at AMC's Breaking Bad, so make sure you are checking that out. As always, a big thanks to our sponsors of offworlddesigns.com. Use promo code BROHOOF to get 10% off your entire order. Audible.com, NobleKnight.com, and many, many others who help make these shows very possible. So, guys, until next time, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying, live free or die hard. And I'll catch you guys right here on ThisWeekInGeek.net.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Oh my God, there's snot on my face. And I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dub. And I'm not a join. Not a join. What the f*** does that mean? F*** that. 10 seconds.
No, you gotta keep that.
Let's do this. Let's do this right the first time.
F*** you guys. Ew, it's in my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, what's it taste like, Mike?
Water. Ew, salty.
Let's start this episode with shat f***.
okay, I'm good, Geico.
Holy shit! Oh my gosh! Freak! Die! Holy crap! Whoa! Where did it go?
I'm like a stupid monkey.
As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear, somebody random. I don't know. Maybe even a hot chick. Yeah, let's go with that.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were very, very sexy?
How are you? Actually, no.
They never will.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Send us a Twitter message by replying to @ThisWeekInGeek. Lastly, you can email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by Prono Bozo at PronoBozo.com. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.